Welcome back to another deep dive. Today we're tackling something that is, and I don't use this phrase lightly, quite literally the backbone of the modern world.
It really is. We're talking about the material that holds up our bridges, frames our skyscrapers.
The car you might be driving in right now.
Exactly. And the scale of it is just staggering. We're looking at steel, specifically the 1.6 billion tons of it that are consumed every single year.
1.6 billion tons. I mean, that number just creates sort of mental static. It's so big. But here's the kicker, and this is why I love these deep dives. To understand that mountain of metal, we have to zoom in.
Way in.
Down to the atomic level.
Because all those properties, whether your bridge stands or your car crumples in a crash, it all depends on how trillions of atoms arrange themselves when the metal cools down. It's a choreography.
And today we're focusing on the main character in that story, the protagonist of the steel world, you could say, something called allotriomorphic ferrite. Now, be honest, material scientists just make these names up to sound smart, right?
It does have a certain ring to it, doesn't it? But the name is actually incredibly descriptive. Allotriomorphic comes from the Greek for a foreign form.
A foreign form? That sounds a little ominous.
It's not so much ominous as it is. It's submissive, I guess. It means the crystal doesn't get to have its own characteristic shape. Its form is dictated by the boundaries it grows on. It's irregular.
Okay, let's unpack this. So we start with this hot, solid phase called austenite, the parent phase.
Right.
And as it cools, this ferrite starts to form. Our mission today is to dig into the kinetic science of that whole process. And we're basing this on chapter 4 of HKDH Padesha's text, Theory of Transformations in Steels.
A classic text, yeah. We're going to look at the shapes, the interfaces, basically how these crystals talk to each other.
Let's start right there with the shape. You said foreign form and irregular. Why is the most common structure in steel so messy?
It's all about location, location, location. Allotriomorphic ferrite nucleates it. It starts to form at the grain boundaries of the austenite.
So on the borders between the parent crystals.
Precisely. And because it's on a boundary, it finds it much, much easier to grow along that boundary than to push deep into the grain.
Like water running along a crack in the pavement.
That is a perfect analogy. Imagine pouring water on a tiled floor. It just races along the grout lines, doesn't it?
Right.
That's this ferrite. It races along the grain boundaries, and by the time it starts to thicken, it's already outlined the old austenite grain. It never gets a chance to form its own nice geometric shape because it's, well, it's hugging the wall.
So if I look at a steel beam under a microscope, those messy outlines I see, that's it.
That's the stuff. The most prolific phase in most steels. You are looking at the foreign form.
But the source contrasts this with something else, idiomorphic ferrite. Now, idio usually means self or distinct, right?
Right. Its own form. Idiomorphic ferrite is the rebel. It doesn't grow on the boundary. It forms inside the grain.
Usually on a piece of dirt or an inclusion, the text says.
Exactly. So because it's sort of floating in the middle of the grain, it's not hitting a wall right away. It can grow freely.
And it gets to express its own internal crystal structure.
It gets to be itself because it forms these beautiful faceted geometric crystals, like little jewels compared to the messy allotriomorphs.
So we have the wall huggers and the free spirits. But then there's a third type that seems to just break all the rules, massive ferrite.
Ah, massive ferrite, a fascinating beast. See, normally when austenite turns to ferrite, it has to push carbon out of the way.
Right, because ferrite can't hold as much carbon.
Exactly. And that diffusion, that movement of atoms, takes time. But massive ferrite, it cheats. It inherits the exact composition of the parent.
It keeps the carbon.
It keeps everything. It doesn't wait. And because it doesn't wait for diffusion, it can grow incredibly fast. It just tears across grain boundaries like they're not even there.
Is that why it's called massive?
Partially, yeah. The resulting grains can be huge. But there's a very strict rule for when this can happen. It only occurs below a specific temperature called T0. That's the thermodynamic speed limit. It's the temperature where austenite and ferrite of the same composition have the exact same free energy. Above TO, it's impossible. Below it, the energy balance flips, and if you cool it fast enough, bam, massive ferrite.
Okay, so we've got the cast of characters, but let's zoom in even further, the interface. How do these new crystals actually connect to the old ones?
This is where the physics gets really elegant. You have two main types of interfaces, glissile and sessile.
Glissile sounds like glide.
And that's exactly what it is. A glissile interface is semi-coherent.
Mm-hmm.
The atoms match up so well that the interface can just glide forward. Think of it like a military formation moving with precision.
And sessile.
Sessile means sitting. These interfaces are stuck. The atomic match is poor. For them to move, atoms have to physically climb or diffuse across. It's much slower.
The source mentioned a step mechanism here, like a staircase.
Yeah, that's a great way to picture it. Imagine the interface isn't a flat wall, but a series of steps. The flat parts, the terraces, are really stable and sessile. They don't want to move.
But the risers, the steps themselves, they can move.
Right. The crystal grows by adding atoms to those steps, and the steps sweep across the terrace. But as you cool things down, the driving force gets so huge that the interface can just break free of those energy wells and move continuously.
Which brings us to how they align. Orientation relationships. I saw some famous names here. Kurjumov-Sachs.
Yeah, Nishiyama Wasserman.
Yeah.
The KS and NW relationships. They're the gold standards. Nature wants to be lazy, right? It hates high energy.
It wants a good fit.
A good fit. So the new ferret crystal rotates itself to find a low energy angle where its atomic planes match up beautifully with the parent austenite.
Okay, but hang on. This is where it gets confusing for me. You just said it wants a good fit. But if it fits so well, why is the shape so irregular?
You've hit on the paradox of growth. This is one of the coolest insights in the chapter from a researcher named C.S. Smith.
Walk us through it.
Okay. Imagine a ferret nucleus forming on a grain boundary. That boundary separates two austenite grains, right? Let's call them grain A and grain B.
Okay, A and B.
The ferret nucleus orients itself to have a perfect, low-energy, coherent fit with grain A. It locks into that KS relationship.
So it's a tight, cozy fit.
Very stable. Think of it like a zipper that's zipped up tight. You can't really move it sideways, can you?
No, it's locked in place.
Exactly. A coherent interface is pretty much immobile. It's stuck. Now look at the other side of that ferret nucleus. It's facing grain B.
Which is randomly oriented.
Totally random. So if the ferret fits perfectly with grain A, it has a terrible, chaotic, incoherent fit with grain B. It has a good side and a bad side.
Okay.
But here's the kicker. Atoms can jump across that messy, chaotic, incoherent interface very, very easily. It is highly mobile.
So you're telling me it turns its back on the grain it matches with and grows aggressively into the grain it doesn't match with.
That's precisely it. It grows into the bad neighbor because that's the only interface that can actually move. It explains why the orientation relationships we measure are often with the grain the ferret grew away from, not the one it consumed.
That is just, it's completely counterintuitive.
It really is. The hate is high energy, and that high energy drives the motion.
So we know how it grows, but how does it even start? The energy costs of nucleation.
Right, the startup cost of thermodynamics. You have to create new surface area, and that costs energy. If a new crystal is too small, its own surface energy will crush it. It just dissolves back.
It has to reach that critical size, the Ristar.
Correct. So you need a shortcut. You don't start in the middle of nowhere. That's homogeneous nucleation, and it's almost impossible in steel. You start on a defect.
Heterogeneous nucleation. You steal existing surface area.
And there's a definite hierarchy to the best spots.
A real estate ranking.
Totally. Number one, the best spot is a grain corner, where four grains meet. Number two is a grain edge, where three meet. And number three is a grain face, where just two meet.
And corners are the best because you get the biggest energy refund.
You get the biggest refund on your energy bill, exactly. You destroy the most high energy boundary area.
And this brings up the shape of the grains themselves. And I think most of us just picture bubbles or something. But the text gets very specific.
The Kelvin truncated octahedron.
Sounds like something from a geometry final exam.
It kind of is. It's the ideal shape for filling 3D space with the minimum surface area. A 14-sided shape with 6 squares and 8 hexagons.
And that's what a real grain of austenite looks like.
In an ideal sense, yes. It has 24 corners and 36 edges. So when we do the math on nucleation rates, we're not just guessing. We're counting the corners in a Kelvin truncated octahedron.
That's the kind of detail I love. It's not a blob. It's a 14-sided, mathematically perfect blob.
Right.
Okay, let's pivot to something that usually gets a bad rap. Inclusions. Basically, dirt in the steel.
Usually, yeah, you want steel to be as clean as possible. Inclusions can cause cracks. But there's a plot twist.
But the twist.
Sometimes we want the dirt, specifically in welding.
Why in welding?
When you weld, you're melting and recooling metal really fast. You can get these huge austenite grains. And if they transform it to big, blocky plates of ferrite, the weld becomes very brittle.
Bad news for a pipeline or a ship.
Terrible news. So what we want is to force nucleation to happen inside the grain. We want a structure called a acicular ferrite.
Which is like a chaotic basket weave.
Exactly. Very tough, very strong. To get it, you need those idiomorphic crystals we talked about earlier. The ones that grow on dirt.
But not just any dirt. You need good dirt.
We need good dirt. And what makes it good comes down to two things. lattice matching, and chemistry.
Okay.
So take titanium monoxide, TiO. The crystal lattice misfit between TiO and ferrite is only about 3%. It's an almost perfect landing pad for a new ferrite crystal.
So the ferrite sees the TiO and says, hey, this looks like home.
Pretty much. But then there's the chemical trick, and this is my favorite part. Some oxides, like titanium oxide, Ti2O3, they actively change the steel around them.
How do they do that?
T2O3 is hungry for manganese. It's like a little sponge. It sucks the manganese atoms out of the steel right around it and pulls them into the oxide.
And why do we care about manganese?
Manganese is an austenite stabilizer. It helps keep the steel in that parent phase. So if you take the manganese away, the austenite becomes unstable. It wants to turn into ferrite.
So the particle creates a manganese depleted zone around itself where ferrite is just begging to form.
It's a double whammy. You provide the perfect structural template and a huge chemical push right where you want it. That's how we engineer high toughness welds using dirt.
That is incredibly clever. It's turning a defect into a feature.
It really is metallurgical judo.
Okay, so we've covered shapes, nucleation, and the magic of inclusions. We have to talk about speed, kinetics. What's the speed limit here?
Padeshi uses this great electrical analogy, the resistor analogy. Imagine the transformation process as a current flowing through two resistors in series.
I remember this from high school physics, vaguely.
Right. So resistor one is the interface.
Mm-hmm.
How fast can atoms physically jump across that boundary?
Okay.
Resistor two is diffusion. How fast can the carbon atoms get out of the way?
So for the interface to move, the carbon has to leave.
Precisely. And in a series circuit, the current, the overall speed, is always controlled by the biggest resistor, the bottleneck.
So which one is it?
Well, in most steel transformations, the interface is ready to go. It's a small resistor. The bottleneck is the carbon. Diffusion is sluggish. So the process is diffusion controlled.
The interface moves only as fast as the carbon can leave, like waiting for a crowd to exit a room.
That's a great way to put it. But sometimes, if you have one of those sluggish sessile interfaces, the interface itself is the bottleneck. That's interface control.
And there's this other thing mentioned, soft impingement. Sounds like a polite way of bumping into something.
It's a bit more drastic than that. Imagine throwing two stones into a pond.
Oh.
The ripples spread out, and eventually they hit each other.
Okay.
As all these little ferrite grains grow, they're all dumping carbon into the austenite ahead of them. They're creating these carbon-rich fields.
And if you have lots of grains growing at once,
those carbon fields overlap. The ripples collide. And the remaining austenite in between them gets completely stuffed with carbon from all sides.
And since high carbon makes austenite more stable,
the driving force for transformation just plummets. It's like carbon constipation. The growth process creates its own break.
Yeah.
That's soft impingement. It can stop the transformation long before all the austenite is gone.
So the process chokes itself off.
Exactly. And modeling that is one of the hardest parts of predicting how steel will behave.
Wow. We have covered a massive amount of ground here. From liquid steel to a solid 14-sided grain, picking a corner, managing the interface, using good dirt.
And navigating the traffic jams of carbon diffusion. And all of that happens billions and billions of times in every single steel girder and car chassis out there.
It's incredible complexity hidden in plain sight, but I want to leave our listeners with a thought from the very end of the source material. It just struck me as surprisingly philosophical.
I think I know the part you mean, the reality check.
Yeah. The text says we have all these elegant theories for spheres and ellipsoids. We have the Kelvin truncated octahedron. But then it admits that reality is, quote, fraught with difficulties.
It is. In the real world, you can't predict the exact number of nucleation sites. The real world is messy. Steel is messy.
So scientists rely on pragmatism. They fit parameters to the messy data. They
can try. Only admission, really.
Yeah.
We can understand the single atom perfectly, but predicting the whole beam requires a bit of fudging, you know?
Okay.
We calibrate our models to match the chaos of reality.
Which really makes you wonder, doesn't it? How much of our built world is based on exact first principle science and how much is based on this pragmatic approximation?
Probably more of the latter than we'd like to admit. But hey, the bridges are still standing.
That is the important part. Something to mull over the next time you drive across one. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
See you next time.